You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. When you think about people seeking refuge in the United States, you think about the southern border, right? Families making a dangerous trek through Mexico, headlines about border walls, caravans, and children in cages. Many of the migrants apprehended at the U.S. border are from Central America. They're fleeing poverty, violence, and climate change. But asylum seekers from Central America are just one part of a global crisis, one that's hit a pretty shocking milestone. According to the United Nations, roughly 80 million people have been forced to flee their homes and are currently displaced. Nearly 30 million are refugees, meaning they cross an international border. The world's refugee population is the highest it's been since World War II. This week, we're looking at refugee communities around the world. What role can and should the United States play in helping displaced people? Is it a humanitarian issue or a matter of national security? Hannah Baba is a veteran journalist and the host of Cross Currents, KALW's award-winning news magazine. She takes it from here.
In January 2017, Marianne Hassan was exhausted, deeply in debt, and feeling hopeful. She'd been living in the United States for over a decade and had finally arranged for her family to come and join her. Then former President Trump signed an executive order banning foreign nationals from seven majority Muslim countries, the so-called Muslim ban.
My parents were in Nairobi, in a hotel, paying all that, and the shutdown happened, and I was like, not now, please, not now. I felt, why me? That's the only thing came up. It was, why me? Why us? Why now?
They were about to fly over here.
Yeah, my dad just got the visa, and he was like literally almost flying, and that shutdown happened, and it was very hard. It was very painful. It was, what have we ever done? What are we doing wrong? It was a scary moment.
Marianne was born in a small farming town in Somalia. When her country devolved into civil war, she spent days walking through the desert with her parents and siblings. In 1992, the family settled in Dadaab refugee camp in eastern Kenya. At first, they assumed they wouldn't be there very long. Then they learned they weren't really allowed to leave. Kenya's encampment policy confines its refugee population to designated settlements within the country. Marianne's family's only hope was to immigrate to another country, a process that takes years. Marianne's brother Assad was born in Dadaab refugee camp. He learned to read and write by scratching letters in the sand there. By the time he was 12, he taught himself English and read Nabokov between chores, and he'd never stepped foot outside the camp where he was born. Marianne managed to leave for the U.S. in 2005, and she promised Assad he would join her there. But after years of filing paperwork, paying application fees, and attending the required medical appointments, Assad and the rest of her family were still trapped in Dadaab. President Trump's Muslim ban stalled the little momentum that their visa applications had.
On the day that Trump's travel ban came into effect, something like 14,000 people in Dadaab were at some stage of the process to get resettled to the United States. Just 8 people were resettled in 2018 from Dadaab, and 14 were resettled in 2019.
Ty McCormick is a senior editor at Foreign Affairs and the former Africa editor at Foreign Policy. He's also the author of Beyond the Sand and Sea, One Family's Quest for a Country to Call Home. Ty's book follows Marianne and her younger brother Assad as they fight to reunite their family in the United States. Their immigration saga gives us a rare window into a dysfunctional refugee resettlement process. The system was in desperate need of reform before Donald Trump took office, and under his administration, it stalled completely. Now, Ty and Marianne say the Biden administration just isn't doing enough to fix the damage that Trump's policies have done. I talked with Ty and Marianne about this on a Zoom call last month. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah.
Marianne, when Ty said he was going to write your life story, what was your reaction?
It was so amazing. I wanted somebody to hear me. So I'm happy that he wrote it. I'm very blessed to Ty to talk about me in the book. And this is my life. It's not about story to me. I lived this life and, you know, it was my journey and it's the truth. So I'm happy, you know, where I am today and how it all went.
Ty, if we go back, you met Marianne and her family through Assad, through reading his articles. Tell us about that. And then what was it about Marianne, Assad, and their parents that drew you to their story?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it was the Trump travel ban that brought Assad, Marianne's brother, and I together for the first time. At the time, I was the Africa editor of Foreign Policy magazine based in Nairobi, and it was a news story that we had to cover. And I had been to Dadaab before, and I was sort of following news from there. And in fact, I had read an article in the New York Times magazine by a young man who had grown up in the camp, and it was Assad. And I filed Assad's name away, and I thought maybe someday down the road there will be an opportunity to reach out to him and offer him a chance to write. Never in a million years did I think he would still be stranded in the camp. I thought for sure that because I was reading his writing in the pages of the New York Times, that he had been one of the lucky few to get out. When I wrote to him a day or two after the Trump travel ban, and I asked him, would you be willing to track down families that are directly affected, people who were expecting to come begin new lives in America, but now are contending with this ban on them? And Assad wrote me back, and he said, this is my story. This is my family's story. We've been waiting for 13 years since we were promised resettlement, more than 20 years at that point since they had fled the war in Somalia. And he wrote something to me to the effect of, the world is working against us. And so I asked if he would write about his family's experience. And he wrote this beautiful, heart-wrenching piece for me at Foreign Policy, telling the story of those 13 years in which he described himself as having been living the American dream that whole time, but not sure how much longer he could bear to live it outside of the United States. So that was the background for how I met Assad, and of course was immediately taken with him, was immediately taken with Marianne and the rest of the family. I wrote the book in part because of a profound change in the way refugee crises have played out that has happened over the last 30 years or so. Just in my lifetime, the refugee camps like Dadaab have gone from being temporary safe havens to being places of permanent exile. In 2015 and 2016, during the crisis in the Mediterranean, I think a lot of Americans got a sense that the scale of the refugee crisis was immense, that more people had been displaced then than at any time since World War II. I think what was missing from the conversation then and still at this time was just how long people have been displaced for. There was one statistic in particular that just absolutely blew me away, which is that the average length of what the UN calls a protracted refugee crisis, which is one that's lasted for 6 years and doesn't have an immediate prospect of being resolved, the average length of one of those in the mid-1990s was 8 years. Now it's 26 years. So many of these refugee crises have just been frozen in time.
Like these refugee camps, you describe in the book, they're permanent temporary camps. That's such an interesting way to think about it. This is decades and decades of second generation people being born in these camps that were meant to be temporary.
Yeah, we now have a second and a third generation grappling with what it means to be a permanent exile. So that's the sort of larger context of the book. Of course, the book focuses on Marianne and her family's incredible 30-year journey. They are, in many ways, a representative case of what has happened to so many refugees who have waited for 3 decades now for a place to find home. And of course, there are about 12 million of those people who have been left behind in places like Dadaab and are stranded there indefinitely. Dadaab is not an easy place to report from, in part because of all of the restrictions that the Kenyan government puts in place to keep people from leaving and from coming. In the book, I compared Dadaab to the fictional town of Macondo, which is cut off from civilization by, in Garcia Marquez's language, measureless swamps and forbidding mountain ranges. And Dadaab is also cut off from civilization. And like Macondo, it's visited by only a very few foreign travelers. And so, no, it's incredibly difficult. There are all sorts of ways in which the government tries to prevent you from actually reaching the people you might want to speak with. And it is, of course, there are limitations on the model of foreign correspondence, that you are necessarily an outsider. You will never be able to see things or narrate stories the way that people who live them do. I think what was neat about the experience of writing this book was that I felt that Assad and Marian were guides to me in their world, and in a more limited way, I could be guides about my world to them. And so we each got to see each other's worlds through one another's eyes to a degree.
Right, because there's a lot of talk about who tells whose story. And so, again, I'm so glad Marian is with us. And it sounds like they were a huge part of the telling of their own story. So I think that's something to be appreciated for sure. Marian, can you describe what it was like growing up in Dadaab for those of us who have not seen it? And maybe we'll not see it. Can you describe it?
Dadaab is a refugee camp. You are living your life. Sometimes you're a teenager and maybe you're a 20-year-old. You can't do anything. You can't work. You can't help your parents. There's no jobs. So it's kind of very hard, especially young generation. Like, you can see your parents struggling and there's nothing you can do for them. You hope just a little bit, you know, maybe a little door that to get out of here and get settlement. And it's hard. It's a lot of kids killed themselves. Last time we went there, me and Ty, there was a kid who killed himself because he felt life is just, there's nowhere to go. There's nothing to do. And it's a hard place.
At the same time, your brother Assad was able to do this process of self-education, which is really fascinating, where he kind of taught himself, you know, English. And he was reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez in the camp. And if you can talk about that a little bit, this idea of being in a place where you feel, you know, there's no hope and there's nothing to do. But then what does it take for you to be that person who says, actually, I can carve out this little place for me and create myself in that way? Can you talk a little bit about Assad? He seems to me an amazing person.
Assad is very hard-headed. He feels...
That's what it takes, maybe, yeah.
Like, it's not a lot of people who will support you on your education. Even with my mom, she thinks, oh, you're just reading all the time. You lost your eyesight. Stop reading, you know? But he had his own way of dealing with life. You know what? If I'm going to get out of here or do something with my life, I'm just going to be inside the books. And that's what he did. He lived his own life.
Yes.
So it was his own journey that he wanted to be with the books, and it worked for him.
And at some point, if we go back to the time when you were in Dadaab and you were able to escape and go to the big city, go to Nairobi, you know, you made that decision to leave and leave to the United States and bring your family. How did your family's journey to the U.S. begin? It was very, I mean, bumpy and rough is an understatement. It felt like these obstacles, you know, like an obstacle race where you're running and running and running, and then you have to jump over something and then you run some more and then somebody throws something. And reading your story, that's what it felt like. Can you describe it to us? Well, what that was like?
First of all, I was the oldest of my mom's side of the family. So growing up, my dad was old and he lost his eyesight when I was 10. And in young age, all I knew was take care of your family, take care of your parents. So I went to Nairobi. I was working, trying to make, you know, how can I help my family? I never had anything else in my head. All I wanted was, how can you support your family? And then all of a sudden we got resettlement to come to America. And I was thinking, oh, this is a good thing. And I came and I was supporting them. I was sending money. I was working.
A lot of money.
Yeah. And I was thinking, oh, they're going to come. It's next year, probably. It was just this hope of never ending and very struggling.
There were the costs associated with green card applications for Marianne's parents. Then she had to hunt for a co-sponsor for them and pay their legal fees. At one point, U.S. government officials questioned whether Marianne's mother was really related to her, and Marianne had to pay out of pocket for their DNA tests. It was an endless bureaucratic maze, even before Trump's Muslim ban, and Ty describes it vividly in his book. And a lot of the book is some wonderful just reporting, right? This is journalism. It's storytelling, but it's also reporting and it's information and it's just setting the stage, right, for this amazing story to unfold. And the stage is pretty bleak. What did you want people to understand about this broken refugee system through this book?
There's one way to read this book, which is as a narrative of triumph over obstacles in a way. And I think that what I hope people take away is a better sense of those obstacles themselves.
But it's a human triumph over obstacles. It's like the humans trying to solve what the systems could not.
Exactly. And it's the systems that I hope people come away with a better sense of. So much of this is invisible to people who don't have to go through it. I think people like Marianne have such an incredible knowledge of this faceless bureaucracy that to the rest of us just operates kind of at a low level in the background. But it has this tremendous ability to make decisions that affect people's lives, life-ending decisions in some cases. And so that's really what I was trying to do. A big part of the book is the story of refugee resettlement in the United States, which I think a lot of people maybe aren't aware just how many refugees the United States has resettled since 1980. Of course, this is a country with a very checkered history in this department. We turned away Jewish refugees in the 1930s. We turned away South Vietnamese refugees in the 70s. Over and over again, there have been waves of refugees that have been turned back. But there have also been waves of refugees that have been welcomed. And since 1980, the United States has actually been pretty good in this department. And we've resettled 3 out of 4 refugees that were resettled anywhere in the world since 1980. 3 million out of 4 million people. In any given year, the United States is resettling more refugees than the rest of the world combined, than the 36 or 37 designated refugee resettlement countries put together, places like Canada, the UK, Australia. The Trump presidency brought that to a screeching halt. Dadaab arguably was the place that was the most affected on a per capita basis. So overnight, the entire humanitarian apparatus geared toward giving people better lives was shut down. There was no flights. There was no vetting. There was nothing. And so this is the story of what it means to throw that away for a country. You give away something that had been the envy of the world, that had given people hope. Certainly every time I've traveled to Dadaab, I think that has meaning, that the United States was seen as a beacon of hope, but it was really not seen that way the last time Marianne and I went back to the camp and we had given all of that up.
You're listening to World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. If you want to hear more of our stories from around the world, you can check out our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now back to Hanna Baba's conversation with Marianne Hassan and Ty McCormick.
When Marianne went back to Dadaab to visit her family, her brother Assad had grown into a gangly teenager. He was bookish and precocious, and as a native of the refugee camp, he didn't feel like he belonged anywhere. Assad couldn't get a Kenyan passport, even though he was born there, and he faced discrimination there too.
Ty, in the book, there was a part where it was 2015, Al-Shabaab had just launched an attack in Kenya. And somebody came to Assad and said, you know, I think it would be a good idea if you could write a letter of apology on behalf of all Somali people. And Assad said, no, you know, I'm not doing that. I had nothing to do with that. I'm not a terrorist. I'm not going to be an apologist for terrorists. That's them. This is me. And that seems to be a question that's at the center of all of this, this idea of suspicion, these people, you know, with terrorist tendencies, that whole conversation. To what extent is it really about that, or is it about something else?
That's certainly part of Assad's experience growing up. You know, I think that one of the many layers of disadvantage that people have who live in the refugee camps is there is a fair amount of anti-Somali sentiment in Kenya. And that, of course, has been fueled by actual terrorist attacks. There have been terrorist attacks. So it's not an imaginary threat, but it's been projected onto the whole population in the same way that it has in the U.S. And so this was something that Assad dealt with his whole childhood, both in the disdain of the Kenyan aid workers for the Somali refugees in the camp. Then when he went to a school in interior Kenya where he was the only Somali in the whole town and his other classmates joked that he was a member of Al-Shabaab and teased him behind his back, you know, all the way through growing up, that was also part of why he traveled back to Somalia. Before he came here, he went on a journey with his friend Becker back to Somalia, traveled through some of the most war-torn parts of the country because he'd never been to his home country. He'd never seen, you know, his parents' home country. But he was looking to see if there was a place that he belonged because he had never felt that he belonged in Kenya. Kenya, of course, told him explicitly by not recognizing him as a citizen that he did not belong. And so he goes back to Somalia. He finds that in some ways he can connect to the culture there, but in other ways he finds that he's a misfit and that he's still searching for this place where he will belong.
In 2018, Assad's hard work paid off. He was accepted to Princeton and awarded a full scholarship. But his immigration status continued to cause problems.
When he applied to Princeton, he had to fill out a citizenship field and the common application. There was no option for a stateless person. He had to choose, am I Kenyan, am I Somali? And he decided that Somali was the smaller lie because Kenya had explicitly told him that he was not a citizen.
And still Assad comes through the airport and you're waiting for him and he doesn't come through right away. And he's still held for interrogation at the airport after all that vetting.
Yes. And Assad was also vetted forever and ever, but he actually never came through the UN resettlement process. He came on a student visa for Princeton, and that was an incredibly difficult process just on its own. He had this golden ticket in the form of an admission letter to Princeton, a full scholarship that covered all of his school fees, all of his living expenses. But of course, he didn't have a passport. He didn't have even a national ID at the time that he received that. And so he had to get what's called a conventional travel document from the UN that the embassy in Nairobi, the US embassy, was willing to place a visa into. So it was a separate system of vetting that was not through the UN. It was similar to any other student, foreign student, who would come on a student visa to come here.
And even the Princeton acceptance letter did not... you know, did not help him in that airport.
No. And in fact, Princeton took this extraordinary step, in my view, of hiring a law firm to write a 15 or 20 page memo about all the reasons why he should not be, why the Trump travel ban should not apply to him, beginning with the fact that he was born in Kenya, not in Somalia, so he was technically not Somali, and going on through to the fact that he had a student visa. But that tells you, you know, if a university on whose campus you've never set foot is, you know, thinks it's necessary to hire a law firm to do an extraordinary amount of research and arm you with a memo before you begin the process of trying to travel here, tells you something about what kind of immigration hurdles you are going to have to clear.
Today, Assad is studying literature at Princeton, and he's on track to graduate in 2022. He's managed to escape Dadaab, but he's still looking for a place he can really call home.
I hoped fervently that that would be New York. Of course, everyone belongs in New York. And in some ways, I think that he's found that here. But in other ways, he arrived in the middle of the Trump presidency when we were not showing our best face to the rest of the world. And we had turned inward and smaller and meaner in a way that weighed really heavily on him. It was obvious to me that I think he was disappointed by the America that he encountered.
As a candidate, President Biden said he'd reverse Trump's refugee policies. He promised the U.S. would welcome up to 125,000 refugees a year. But 4 months into his presidency, immigration advocates say he's fallen short.
To see the Biden administration not race to restore something that was such an integral part of America's way that it presents itself as a leading power, as a soft power tool, as a way of leading by example, has been really disappointing.
And you recently wrote about this in a New York Times op-ed. What will it take to undo this damage that the Trump administration did to refugee policy? Even if the Biden administration immediately kind of jumped on it, what would need to be done?
Yeah, even if the Biden administration had decided to get to work on day one rectifying this, it would have been a huge, huge lift because so much damage was done to the system by essentially shutting it down with no warning overnight. It's an imperfect analogy, but like any piece of heavy machinery, if you shut it down, it's tremendously expensive to keep it from being damaged. You shut down an oil pipeline overnight, you do millions and millions of dollars of damage to it. That's true of the refugee pipeline as well. Resettlement agencies had to close their doors. They had to lay people off. A tremendous amount of human capital that, you know, was geared toward helping people when they arrive. When Marion arrived in the U.S., the international rescue community was there waiting to help her resettle in an apartment. And there's a tremendous amount that goes into making sure that refugees can land on their feet when they get here. And all of that has been set back and will take, you know, years, I think, before it's back up and running at the level that it needs to be. And I should also add that even if it were to be restored to the level, we're still nowhere close to addressing the global need for resettlement. This is a system that resettles globally through the UN less than 1% of refugees every year, which is why you have ended up with this age of encampment with people who are stranded for generations and generations. It's because only a tiny number of the people who need homes, need new countries, are given them. And so actually, if you were serious about fixing the problem, you wouldn't just need to restore the old refugee resettlement system. You would need to build it, expand it, rally new countries to take part in it, and really begin to make a dent in the backlog of people who are waiting and have been waiting for generations. The waiting period for sponsoring a sibling for a green card is something like 14 years or something like that right now. I may have not have the correct number off the top of my head, but it's extraordinarily long and reflective of a system that desperately needs to be overhauled. I think that on the question of resettlement, there's actually a great deal more popular support for resettlement than many people realize, and certainly than Washington acts like. If you ask people in communities across the United States whether they support refugees resettling in their communities, overwhelmingly they say yes. In fact, during the Trump administration, one of the policies that Trump put in place was to give communities essentially veto power over whether or not they got refugees resettled into their communities. And it was clear to me that the Trump administration expected lots of communities to use that veto power to say, we don't want refugees, send them to another community. That did not happen by and large. Overwhelmingly, communities voted to have resettlement proceed or even expand. You know, many communities, I think, have always understood that, particularly in places that have seen, you know, loss in population, have been deindustrialized, have struggled economically, what an incredible boon refugees can be to these communities and how they come and they revitalize places. They start businesses, they hire people. And so that's pretty well understood, I think, at a policy level among local officials. And I think it's pretty well understood by voters who, when they respond to surveys, time and again say that they're in favor of this issue. The holdup, to me, is in Washington, where I think there's a sense that people, they don't believe that Americans really know what they want, and that there's a reluctance to enact what is clearly the popular will on this particular issue.
You know, this fundamental question of people coming to this country and seeking refuge, are we back at square one, or are we somewhere in the middle, or where do you see this?
I think we're stuck kind of at a crossroads here. The Biden administration is of course, also contending with a pandemic that has profoundly affected mobility for everyone, not just for refugees. And I think that in some ways that is shaping the way that they approach these problems. In other ways, it's become an excuse for inaction. The policy questions and the question of language and rhetoric, I think, are easy to separate with the Biden administration. On the campaign trail, it was easy to see the ways in which Biden went out of his way to contrast his own vision with that of Trump's. He presented himself as, if not a champion for refugees, certainly someone who thought compassionately about them, thought this issue was important, and sought to differentiate his platform from Trump's very cold, uncaring platform on that particular policy issue. It's clear, I think, to me now that I was hopeful and I was giving him the benefit of the doubt of that while the campaign was happening, I think, because I wanted to hear that from an American leader. But if you look back at the historical record, Biden has never been very good on refugees. He opposed bringing many South Vietnamese refugees here after the end of the Vietnam War, including those that aided American soldiers in the war effort. He actively tried to prevent those people from being brought over in an emergency evacuation. He seems very unconcerned with the fate of Afghan refugees right now as the United States winds down the war in Afghanistan. It seems clear to me that it is a political calculation, that the Biden administration is very worried about looking soft on immigration as it stares down what it sees as a potential political liability with increased migration at the southern border, particularly from Central America. These are two totally separate policy issues. Asylum at the border is, of course, also a legal right that people have that for the last 4 years or part of that time, they have not been able to exercise the right that they have under international law to claim asylum in the United States. But it is nonetheless a separate issue than resettlement through the UN from third countries. That process.
Right. One is DHS, right? Like the border is handled by DHS and refugees are the State Department.
They're both interagency processes and there are some limited overlap with them. But I think the biggest, most relevant piece or difference is that refugees who come through the UN system are vetted for years and years and years. It's just an incredible level of scrutiny that they have to endure, as Marion can tell you, having been through that system. So I think that while the rhetoric has changed, the narrative has changed, we no longer have an administration that delights in the cruelty of these things. We don't have one that is actively trying to undo the policies that at the end of the day are the things that keep people from living the new lives that they hope that they'll be able to do. When the Biden administration said that they were going to raise the cap, the State Department evidently expected them to do that, and they booked 700 flights for refugees from around the world that they then had to cancel, very embarrassingly in my view, and devastatingly for those who were expecting to get on those flights. It's not very often like you can just get on a later one. These things compound. There are reasons why refugees who are stranded there. I read about one woman who was pregnant and then has since had a child. And so now adding the child to her resettlement case is going to take, you know, months or years and more bureaucratic wrangling. And so she probably won't be on the next flight if there is a next flight. So these kinds of decisions have very, very profound ripple effects on people's lives.
In Dadaab, thousands of families are still waiting patiently for resettlement. But today, Marianne's family is one of the lucky ones. After years of work, she finally managed to assist her parents in immigrating here. Today, they live with her at her home in Milwaukee.
Of course, it's not an altogether happy story. As Marianne will tell you, three of her siblings, but two in particular who are younger, who would like to come are still stranded in Kenya, and Marion is working heroically to get them here, working with a lawyer in Washington State, doing everything she can, but it's been a challenge and they're still there. And so that's part of the story.
Marianne, you've carried a lot on your shoulders. This story is a lot about your strength, your resilience. You've always wanted to be independent. Your father also wanted you to be independent. You know, he was the camp Quran reader. And, you know, he always made this distinction between culture and religion, and always told you that Islam is, you know, gave you your rights, and Islam is not holding you back. It's culture. And he supported you in becoming this young, independent woman. And that's not a story many people here in the West hear about Muslim women. There are, you know, stereotypes about Muslim women, that they are oppressed, that we don't have a voice. Whereas we know so many of our communities, women are the backbones of many Muslim communities. So, and I'm so happy to see that in this book. What about that did you want to show up in this book? You know, the changing the idea about Muslim women and you as a woman and your culture. What do you want people to understand?
We are just as you. We are just a human being. We wear a scarf, we wear hijab, but that doesn't mean we're not human. We are here to make it, and we are very strong women. We don't hold back. And so we work, we help our family, we get married, we take care. We are just like everyone else. So whoever says, oppressed or this or that, it's just misconception or not knowing the reality of other people. We care about our family, we care about our kids, and we take care of each other. So, and that's the human way, not a Muslim way or a Christian way. And so I think that's who we are. And I wish people will understand, even if we are a refugee, we come here, we still want the best for everyone we meet and everyone we encounter. So,
tell me a little bit about your life right now.
My life right now is amazing. I live with my parents and I see them every morning, and that's what I prayed for all these years, and I'm grateful to be with them and my whole fam, my kids and my parents living together. So I'm so honored and I'm happy.
You know, people are going to read this book. What do you want people to understand from it? What do you want people to really, really get out of it?
Yeah, I hope that they can gain a better sense of just how valuable the resettlement system is, both to the country and to the people that are able to begin their lives again as a result of it. I hope they could even imagine themselves in a system, in a condition of being displaced themselves. You know, the fact that Americans have not had a war on their home territory is purely an accident of history, and that tomorrow we could wake up and be affected ourselves. And I think that, so I hope that there's an ability to see that this is a system that that we all benefit from in our own ways, and that is broken and badly in need of repair. And that I think that we can all do the work of starting to build it back block by block.
Marianne, when people read this book and read your story and the story of your family, what do you want them to understand? What do you want them to take away?
No one wants to start life all over in a new place or new. It's like it's a life. It happens. And we're not coming to America in bad intention, or being a refugee is not something we choose. So I just think people will take from this book how humans struggle, and they should open their heart and be open-minded and to know people are struggling, I think.
Marianne Hassan is a Somali refugee. Today she lives in Milwaukee with her family. Ty McCormick's new book is called Beyond the Sand and Sea, One Family's Quest for a Country to Call Home.
You're listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. Special thanks to Hana Baba for that interview. Hana is the host of Cross Currents, a news magazine produced by KALW. She's also the co-host of The Stoop, an award-winning podcast about the Black diaspora. RaceWires picks up the story here.
For people like Marianne and Assad, Dadaab refugee camp is a home of last resort. Today, the Kenyan government is planning to close it.
this is not only a tremendous humanitarian concern with extraordinary consequences for the individuals who would be impacted by it, but it also presents a real concern for regional instability.
Nazanin Ash is the Vice President of Global Policy and Advocacy with the International Rescue Committee.
You know, many of these Somalis have never lived in Somalia. They don't have family ties. They don't have economic ties. You know, the instability that could result from a sudden return involuntarily of, you know, 300,000 Somalis to an unstable Somalia could really see a reignition of ongoing civil conflict. And in fact, I think an issue that's not very well understood, that since the 1990s, of the 15 largest returns of refugees that have happened since 1990, a third of them have resulted in the resumption of conflict. So it goes again to why this is both a humanitarian and a national security, regional security, foreign policy concern.
And it's also getting worse.
So there are almost 80 million people globally displaced right now. Nearly 30 million of those are refugees, which means they've crossed a border to another country and have asked for the safety and protection and have been granted the safety and protection of that country.
Do you think Americans are aware of what's going on among displaced people in the world, or do they kind of tune in and out?
I think that part of what's got lost in the highly politicized debate is that Americans believe that the U.S. should be a place of refuge for those fleeing violence and persecution. We see that over and over again in how Americans have responded over the course of recent history, whether it was the major increases in refugee arrivals post the Vietnam War or during the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1980s, or whether it was with increases in refugee arrivals given the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan and more recently Syria and now again Central and South America. So I think Americans are very well in tune to the history and context of displacement and again believe in the U.S.'s role. I think what's less well understood, though, is what you would glean from the media is that it is the U.S. that is hosting the vast majority of refugees, for example, when in fact, the vast majority of the world's refugees, almost 90% of them, are hosted in low and middle income countries that directly neighbor the crises from which most refugees are fleeing.
If you're in the United States, refugee flows cycle in and out of the news. The American news consumer is mostly getting news about the U.S. southern border these days. But what we see and what's really happening may be two very different things. Where are people leaving home right now?
It wouldn't surprise you or Americans to anticipate that the places from which refugees are fleeing now are those largest humanitarian crises globally, where the triple impact of COVID, of crisis and conflict, and climate change are really resulting in crises that have motivated and mobilized the largest displacement of people in history since World War II. So there are 20 countries globally that host just 10% of the world's population, but account for 85% of the world's humanitarian needs and 84% of the world's refugees. And what's interesting about many of these contexts is they have been in prolonged crisis where you have governments that either because they cannot or because they will not have failed to be able to respond to the needs of their populations and where people are fleeing to find safety for themselves and for their families.
There are a lot of things that drive different refugee crises: civil war, internal conflict, ethnic and religious conflict. This has been the age of the displaced, tens of millions at any one time. How come through this whole era, the world hasn't figured out a workable response, a set of machinery that actually responds and keeps up with these shifting multinational crises.
The international community did come up with a response and a framework, and they did that in that post-World War II environment where unmanaged flows of people in crisis really presented huge humanitarian concerns, but also regional stability and security concerns. I think the challenge that you rightly identify is that those frameworks have really been stressed by current trends. And, you know, these are trends that have now been with us for a number of decades. So considering that, you know, there are 20 countries that produce 84% of the world's refugees, and also considering that many of those countries are protracted crises where humanitarian assistance has been provided in some cases for 20 years or more, really tells you that we need a reinvigorated international response that both addresses root causes and has an ability to help resolve some of these conflicts that are increasingly internal. We also need to reinvigorate global responsibility for displacement. And that's why the commitment that the Biden administration made was so critical. Because if you consider that 90% of the world's refugees are hosted in low and middle income countries, it really speaks to the imbalance in global responsibility for caring for refugees.
But even while raising the threshold, the United States is still well short of where it used to be.
Yes, that's true. And it'll be a journey to return to where the United States used to be. And I think that's a really important marker. You know, refugee admissions has become incredibly politicized over the last 4 years with the Trump administration. But its history is really of sustained bipartisan support. So the average number of refugee admissions across the 40-year of the U.S. refugee admissions program before Trump was 95,000. And that was a number that held across both Republican and Democratic administrations, with some of the highest numbers of refugees admitted under Republican administrations. So it's important first to identify that the Trump administration was really an anomaly in its response to admitting refugees and really stood out from a history of bipartisan support for doing so. And at the same time, as you point out, we're far below the number, admitting the number of refugees that reflects our global obligations, our global interests, and our national capacity. You know, this is a program that delivers on U.S. humanitarian leadership. It delivers life-saving assistance to the most vulnerable of refugees, and it delivers on our national security, foreign policy, and even economic domestic outcomes.
Earlier, you mentioned World War II, and I think it's a really important example because between Madrid and Moscow, there were millions upon millions of displaced persons. But there was one key difference. Volga Germans knew they weren't going back to Russia. Silesian Germans knew they weren't going back to southern Poland. A lot of the displaced persons needed to be resettled, and there was a wide understanding that they simply were no longer going to live in their country of origin any longer. And one thing that we haven't done in the modern age is come to some common wisdom on when a refugee is no longer a refugee, but someone who is now in a new place that they're going to be. Some of these latest migrations result in new realities, both in the receiving countries and the countries that they're departing from. But law and custom and international aid flows just seem a little bit more rigid. And we have to all observe this fiction that people are going home, quote unquote, and they're not. And we just seem to be collectively unwilling to say, you're not a refugee anymore. You live where you live.
It's so interesting that you raise this point, and you're so right to raise it. So on average, just 1% of refugees are given access to resettlement. And as noted, those are the most vulnerable refugees who don't have an opportunity and will not have an opportunity to go home and can't be safe in those countries of first refuge for a variety of reasons. But the other important fact is increasingly, when you look across the last decade, on average, only 3% of refugees have been able to return home. So when you consider sustainable solutions, it's absolutely about interventions and changes in law and policy and financing systems such that low and middle income countries can be supported to extend their social services, extend legal rights to refugees, such that they can rebuild their lives in those new communities. And this is an area of tremendous underinvestment from the global community, both in terms of financing and attention. The opportunity to really transform the response to protracted refugee crises is at hand with the commitments that the Biden administration made.
Do we recognize that it's more than just material and economic aid, but that countries handling big flows can sometimes be politically destabilized, that they need a little help because suddenly there are all these people, a lot of people poured into Greece in the midst of their worst economic crisis in their whole modern history. Turkey, during a time of economic and international turmoil, was suddenly taking on huge numbers of arrivals. Apart from the obvious examples of, a Kenya that isn't wealthy enough to handle large numbers of Somalis, there are countries, that just having all these new people around can be difficult politically, especially if they have elected governments. Colombia is trying to piece itself back together after a long time of internal conflict, and now all these Venezuelans are around, and it's not just a question of making sure they get 3 square meals a day, is it?
No, you're exactly right. And it goes back to why the Refugee Convention was created in that post-World War II environment, because unmanaged refugee crises can beget additional political crises and regional destabilization.
In a recent article that you co-authored with David Miliband, who's the president of the International Rescue Committee, you assign a central role to the U.S. in the world's response to refugee crises in a lot of different places. Why? Is the American responsibility different from that of other wealthy countries?
I think the American opportunity is different than that of other countries, as well as its responsibility. I think we have an exceptional opportunity to be able to provide the kind of humanitarian leadership that can drive increased commitments from other countries to do more. And we provide the kind of political heft and intervention that can help address root causes. So I do think, and it's been demonstrated in our history, that where America leads, the world follows. When the U.S. led at the Leaders Summit in 2016, the outcomes were a 30% increase in humanitarian financing from wealthy nations, and a doubling in the first year and a tripling in the second year of global resettlement slots for the most vulnerable refugees. Those were anchored by U.S. commitments to aid and resettlement, but more importantly, they were anchored by U.S. diplomacy, really leaning in and negotiating those outcomes, leveraging our diplomatic architecture globally and leveraging our diplomatic influence globally. Over the course of the Trump administration, there was a more than 25% reduction in the number of countries participating in resettlement. There was an over 50% decline in global resettlement slots, and humanitarian aid stagnated and in some years declined. And what happened over that same period of time was a 7 million increase in the number of refugees globally. So when we don't lead, these crises take hold, they proliferate, they have follow-on impacts politically and on regional stability, and ultimately the costs accrue to the United States.
Finally, before we close, one of the most distressing aspects of what we've been talking about is the growth in the number of stateless persons. People who are never going back to their country of origin, but are not welcomed in a full, legally recognized and stable way by the places where they are now. Not allowed to become permanent residents, not recognized in law as legally resident, not allowed to take on citizenship even after long periods of residence in their new country. Is the world nimble enough, flexible enough, clever enough to stop the increase in the number of people who really are in that kind of vulnerable position, not really securely belonging anywhere?
This is a real crisis and a very dangerous circumstances for stateless individuals experiencing it. If you consider the way in which your identity and your ability to access safety, to access security, to access services is tied to recognition of your existence. That's fundamentally what we're talking about when we consider stateless individuals. So it's a big part of what organizations like the International Rescue Committee and other humanitarian organizations do globally in seeking to support individuals in securing that recognition of their identity that allows them to seek protection. But it's also a huge area for U.S. diplomacy. So what I want to emphasize here, Ray, is what you have said throughout. You know, responding to displacement crises is not only a function of assistance or a function of, you know, doing your fair share on providing resettlement and a permanent opportunity for refugees to rebuild their lives, but it's a question of our political and diplomatic engagement, what we prioritize with our for our diplomatic muscle and how critical it is to do that prioritization of our diplomatic muscle, to lean in with all that the U.S. can bring to bear in its global relationships to bring some permanent resolution to these protracted displacement crises and the populations affected by them.
Nazanin Ash is Vice President of Global Policy and Advocacy at the International Rescue Committee. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG and First Republic Bank, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. You can also download our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about this episode? Do you have ideas for future stories? Please email us at feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Teresa Katsarilis and Elise Manukian. Mixing and mastering by Jared Sport and Matteo Schimpf. Tatum Sanderbeck manages our website. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.